Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
We continue our Women in the Bible series today on Issues Etc. Esther is the subject. She has an entire book devoted to her story, at least part of her story. Very intriguing reversal of fortune for Esther, although some have doubted that it's true. They say it's just an excuse. It's one of those just-so stories made up to explain why the Jewish people of a certain time practiced or celebrated a certain festival. Purim, I believe, is a festival they're referring to. Let's talk about Esther for the next half hour of the program. I invite your questions and comments, 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc or visit our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. He's a regular guest and professor of theology at Concordia University, Chicago. He's author of the Concordia Commentaries on Proverbs, Daniel, and Ezra and Nehemiah. Dr. Steinman, welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Todd.
Some liberal Bible scholars have said, look, this story is improbable, that a Jewish woman, however, by whatever means, would rise to such influence so as to literally save her people from genocide in this ancient empire. Just seems historically unlikely. How would you respond?
Well, a lot of things that happened in history seemed unlikely, so I don't know how that's an argument. I mean, we could pick out all kinds of examples of things that happened in history that seemed to go against the odds. I don't know what kind of argument that is other than, yeah, so what? The other problem is they usually argue that, well, we don't have any record of Esther, which is true. We don't have any record of her outside the Book of Esther, but there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge of Persian history at this point in the reign of Xerxes. We do have the Greek historians that talk about an earlier queen who I think probably is the same as the Queen Vashti that's mentioned in the Book of Esther in the first chapter. But later in his reign, we just simply don't have enough information to say, okay, there wasn't an Esther. So the idea that it's improbable or that we just don't have any information, I just don't know how to respond to those other than say, yeah, there's lots of places in history we don't have any information, and there's lots of places in history where the improbable happens.
Okay, put us in the context. What is the disposition of God's people at the time that Esther's story is being played out and recorded?
Okay, they've been out of the Holy Land for quite a while, many of them, although some of them have returned to the Holy Land. This is after the first return that's recorded in the Book of Ezra. It's the time of the Persian Empire, and the king is a man that we know from Greek sources named Xerxes. In many Bible translations, he's called Ahasuerus, but it's actually the same person. And Xerxes is a fairly powerful man, certainly the most powerful man in that part of the world. He was known for his campaigns against Greece, and probably that's the reason for the banquets early in the Book of Esther, as he's trying to raise support among his nobles for his campaigns to the west and into Greece. So we have Jews that are scattered throughout the Persian Empire. Some of them have gone back to the Holy Land, but many more of them, like Esther, remain in the east in places like Persia and Babylon. And here we see in the Book of Esther, Esther's family has apparently become fairly prominent in the service of the Persian court. Mordecai, who we meet here, is fairly influential, especially later in the book in the Persian court, which, again, matches what we know, for instance, in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, where we also have Jews who were servants of the Persian kings, and a Jew is as close to the Persian king as Nehemiah would be in a later generation, who is the cupbearer and a very important official to the Persian king. So all this is in keeping kind of with the scene that we know in the books that were written after the Babylonian exile, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, too.
So chronologically, does Esther, I'm talking about chronologically, does her story fall between Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah?
Well, it kind of falls between the first part of Ezra and the second part of Ezra. Okay, Ezra's in two parts.
So it's even later than that.
Yeah, so it's later than Daniel. It's before Nehemiah. It's before Ezra returns to the Holy Land, but after the first Jews return to the Holy Land and rebuild the temple.
Tell us her story. What is this book tell us not only about Esther, but about the palace intrigue in which she finds herself?
Yeah, it's a fairly interesting story that you have, because Xerxes is throwing this banquet. Apparently, if I understand the setting right, and many other Bible scholars would agree with me, he's trying to raise support among his nobles for his campaigns to the west. And he throws this banquet, and he's basically showing off his power here to rally support, and showing off things in his palace. And in the first chapter, we learn of his great wealth and so forth that he's showing off here at the banquet. And the banquet lasts for a number of days, and he apparently, has the wine flowing pretty good. At one point, he's together with the guys, and he decides that he's going to show off also the beauty of his wife, a woman called in Esther 1 Vashti, and he orders her to come in so he can kind of show her off in front of the rest of the fellows, his trophy wife, as it were. And I have to give her credit. She says, no way, I'm not just an object. I think we have to give her a little credit. She's not going to do that. And this kind of sends ripples through the court, that the queen defies the king. And we're told at the end of the first chapter that the king gets together with his advisors, and they put out this decree that, all wives are to respect their husbands and not disobey. And I'm always amused by that. And when I teach this to my students, they say, yeah, like that ever worked in anybody's household. That just doesn't, not the way you deal with things like this, that, we're just going to send out this decree, almost as if they're a little bit insecure in their positions, that all wives have to behave their husbands. But at any rate, Vashti is kind of deposed as queen. And then sometime later, we find that Xerxes decides to replace his queen. And they, in essence, go out and recruit young women to come into the king's harem. And he is going to decide among them which will be the new queen. One of the women who's taken in this process is Esther, and she has a time of preparation. Her cousin Mordecai, who had raised her after her parents died, had told her specifically not to let her ethnic identity be known. She was not to let anybody know in the royal court that she was Jewish. I think Mordecai was probably rightly worried about some prejudice there. And so he tells her not to tell anybody. So she goes into this process. And when it's her turn to be presented to the king, we see Esther's kind of wisdom here, in that she asks the royal steward who's in charge of the harem exactly what it is the king likes, what appeals to him. She's kind of wise about this. If she's going to be married to the king, She wants to be the favored wife, the queen. And so it turns out that Esther does indeed appeal to the king more than the other women. And so we're told that Esther is chosen to be the new queen, which doesn't mean the only wife, but the favored wife. At the same time, we meet Mordecai, and we find out some intrigue going on between Mordecai and a very powerful person in Xerxes' court, a man named Haman. And Haman is very full of himself. We get the impression from reading the book almost as Haman really thinks he ought to be the king, that he's really the one that everybody ought to be bowing down to. He never quite says that, but you get the idea. He's pretty full of himself. And he's really irritated because Mordecai won't bow down to him and scrape to him. Now we find out that Haman is a descendant of a man named Agag. Agag was an Amalekite king. We meet very much earlier in the Old Testament, and he was defeated. The Amalekites were defeated a number of times. The first time was when Israel came out of Egypt, and we have the well-known story of Moses holding up his hands. As long as Moses' hands were up, the Israelites prevailed against them as Joshua led them out in the battle. Because the Amalekites opposed Israel when they came out of Egypt, Moses prophesies that God will have victory over Amalek in every generation.
Let's take a break right there. When we come back, we'll pick up on the story of Esther. Our Women in the Series, Women in the Bible series during this Summer of Issues, etc., live this Wednesday, August the 4th. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. He's professor of theology at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the Concordia Commentaries on Proverbs, Daniel, and Ezra and Nehemiah. Stay tuned.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among his people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
You'll find the reformer Martin Luther's thoughts on Jesus' high priestly prayer and the Passion and Resurrection according to John in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August. Luther's Works, Volume 69. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Luther's Works, Volume 69, by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Luther's Works, Volume 69, The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for August.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Evangelicals' View on Contraception.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The National Association of Evangelicals' recent endorsement of birth control as a means of reducing the number of abortions in America has drawn criticism. While affirming the sanctity of human life, the NAE endorsed contraceptives for couples who are not willing to accept the responsibility of parenting. Bill Brooks of the North Carolina Family Policy Council countered that advocating contraceptive use among the unmarried results in more sex, more pregnancies, and more abortions. In addition, such advocacy of birth control could drive a wedge between evangelicals and the Catholic Church, whose teachings reject contraceptives.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Esther, our Women in the Bible series. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. In about 15 minutes, Brian Brown of the National Organization for Marriage will join us. We'll talk about the overturning this afternoon of California's same-sex marriage ban by a federal judge in San Francisco. That's about 10 minutes away. Dr. Steinman, pick up where you left off. You were telling Esther's story. You were talking about the rivalry that apparently is, in some sense, prophesied between Haman, this man in the king's court, and Mordecai, Esther's relative.
Yeah, it turns out that Mordecai is a descendant of Kish, who was Saul's father. And it's Saul, later on, whom God tells to go out and defeat the Amalekites, and he does. And so there's kind of an ancient rivalry, as it were, hundreds of years old at this point, between Mordecai's family and Haman's family. And Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman because of this, probably this ancient prophecy, you know, that God's going to have victory over the Amalekites. And so Mordecai refuses to bow down to the Amalekite Haman. Haman's just infuriated about this, and he decides it's too little of a thing just to get at Mordecai. He wants to get at all the Jews. And so he goes into Xerxes and said, I'll pay you some money. There's a people in your realm that's just kind of hard to get along with, they just don't fit well under your rule. And if you'll give me the ability to deal with them however I'd like, I'll pay for the privilege. Of course, Haman's figure he's going to wipe them out and take their property and make a profit on the deal at the same time. Well, the king listens to Haman and gives him the ability to do this, even gives Haman a signet ring so he can send out letters in the king's name. And so Haman decides that that's what he's going to do. He's going to send out decrees in the king's name that on a certain day, anybody in the kingdom can attack the Jews. He didn't tell, of course, the king that it was the Jews, but can attack the Jews and kill them and take their property. But being a good pagan, he decides he has to find out the day when the gods, that you know, the pagan gods he believes in, are going to be most favorable to this. So he decides to cast lots. We read about casting lots in the Bible, and he's casting lots apparently before his pagan gods so that they'll tell him which is the right day. And the Persian word for lot is pur. If we kind of take the Persian word pur and make it plural using a Hebrew plural ending, it comes up Purim. He casts the lots. He finds a day. It's almost a year away. So he sends out this decree this can be done. And, of course, Mordecai learns about this, and Mordecai goes into mourning for his people. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. He sits in the king's gate, which is a clue that this is not just some poor Jew. The fact that he can sit in the gate, the king's gate, says that, you know, he had some juice in the palace. But Esther finds out about this, and he's in sackcloth and ashes, and she sends him clean clothes to wear, and he refuses to wear them, and he wants to know what the problem is. And so finally he tells Esther, you know, well, here's this problem. Esther is kind of reluctant to go to the king with the problem. She hasn't revealed that she's a Jew. And so she hesitantly doesn't know what to do. And Mordecai says something very interesting to her. He says, you know, if you don't do something about this, if you don't take a chance and go in to see the king and bring this subject up, you and your family, you know, your father's household might be lost, but help will arise for our people from somewhere. Now, it's interesting that the Book of Esther never uses God's name, never mentions anything really religious, never mentions prayer. The closest it mentions is fasting. The people eventually fast on Esther's behalf, but it kind of hints at Mordecai's faith here, that God will preserve his people because he has this ancient promise of the Messiah, and he's not going to allow his people to be wiped out because he's promised to bring the Messiah through them. And so he kind of hints at it here. Well, in the meantime, Haman has set up this big poll. He's going to have Mordecai executed and hang his dead body up on the pole, kind of as an example. And so, you know, Haman thinks he has everything in order. Esther's debating on what she's going to do. And in the meantime, we find out Xerxes has a restless night. He can't sleep. And so what are they going to do to help the king get to sleep? And so his courtiers decide they're going to read the records of his kingdom to him. And imagine, put it in a modern context, you're trying to get to sleep at night. You just can't get to sleep. They're going to read you something to put you to sleep. Well, you need something kind of boring to put you to sleep, right? It's like reading him the congressional record or something, you know? So they read him the annals of his reign, and they happen to turn to a page where they read about the fact that there was a plot against Xerxes, and it had been foiled. And somebody had brought that information to the king's attention so that he wouldn't be assassinated. And the king says, is there any record of my rewarding this person who did this? And they say, no. Well, I think I need to reward it. Well, the person who had done this was Mordecai. And so when Haman comes in for his daily appointment with the king the next morning, the king says to Haman, what should I do for a man I want to honor? Well, Haman, again, being very full of himself, thinks to himself, well, it must be me. Who else would the king want to honor? And so he says, you know, put him on the king's horse, put a royal robe on him, parade him through the capital city here, Susa, and say, this is what the king does for the person he wants to honor, thinking that that's what's going to happen to him. And the king says, that's a great idea. Go do that for Mordecai. So here you have Haman, who's trying to plot Mordecai's downfall, and there's this great irony that he has to go out and honor Mordecai. So it just makes him much more upset about this whole thing.
So how does the story end with not just a complete reversal, but, I mean, everyone's left at the end of this story saying, if even though God isn't mentioned here, this must have been the hand of God protecting both Esther, Mordecai, and the whole people of God. We've only got about 2 minutes here.
Well, eventually Esther decides to go in and see the king. She asks the people to fast for her, and then she goes in to see the king, and she holds a banquet. Haman's there at the banquet, and the king says, okay, Esther, why'd you hold the banquet? What did you want to talk to me about? And she says, there's been a plot against my people. And the king says, who in the world would plot against your people? And she identifies Haman. And the king leaves the room in a rage, and Haman comes over to Esther on the couch where she's reclined for the banquet and starts begging for his life. And the king comes back in and sees Haman and thinks, uh-oh, he is trying to molest the queen. And so he has Haman dragged out and killed and put on the pole that Haman had set up for Mordecai. And Mordecai then takes over Haman's position kind of as prime minister. He sets forth a decree that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves and preemptively strike the day or two before that the other decree is going to go into effect, and the Jews are able to be saved because Esther takes this action, we learn at the end of the book also Mordecai then and his actions later on as kind of prime minister of the Persian Empire with Esther as queen.
The final question comes from one of our listeners via Facebook. Frank in Cary, Illinois says, is it a stretch to call Esther a type of Christ because she did not die but was willing to sacrifice in order to save her whole people?
Well, we see in her certainly a certain Christ-like quality that she is indeed ultimately willing to do this. Whether we want to call that a type of Christ or not, I think we see a number of people in the Old Testament that are willing to do Christ-like things, that because they are filled with the Holy Spirit and because they trust in the promise of the coming Savior, they have this attitude that God gives them through the gospel of being, having what St. Paul would call in the New Testament the mind of Christ, wanting to live in that way. And so we see this also in Esther, that she has this very Christ-like quality that ultimately she's able to save her people because she's willing to put herself on the line. So if we want to see that kind of parallel, I think that's a good thing to see.
We've only got about 20 seconds. Does the book point us to Christ?
I think the book does point us to Christ, especially in that God uses Esther to save the people so that the messianic promise can be fulfilled God's people aren't wiped out, but God does indeed use this as one step along the way to bringing forth the Savior by preserving his ancient people.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is professor of theology at Concordia University Chicago. He's author of the Concordia Commentaries on Proverbs, Daniel, and Ezra and Nehemiah. Dr. Steinman, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
When we come back from this break, it's been announced that California's same-sex marriage ban, Prop 8, voted on by the electorate there in California, has been overturned by a federal judge in San Francisco. That just announced shortly ago this afternoon. Brian Brown is going to join us. He's executive director of the National Organization for Marriage, and he'll bring us both an update and what's next for same-sex marriage, not only in California. This has national ramifications, or at least it could have national ramifications. If it goes next to the Supreme Court does decide to hear the case and appeal, it certainly will have national ramifications. Brian Brown of the National Organization for Marriage, right after this.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology, and we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever wanted to know about the origins of Issues Etc.? Did you know church leaders were opposed to teaching the laity Reformation theology? Check out our new YouTube video, You Can't Teach Lay People Theology, issuesetc.org, and click support. Equipping the priesthood of all believers. Watch the short YouTube video, You Can't Teach Lay People Theology today. Just go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. live on most smartphones? Just go to the Listen Live page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the smartphone link, and you can listen on your smartphone weekday afternoons between 3 to 5 Central. Old theology, new technology, Issues Etc. now broadcasting live to the world on most smartphones. Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.